The Guardian.
Welcome to another Observer Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. Coming up on this week's show, we'll be speaking to a rising British talent, director Oliver Blackburn, about his feature debut, Donkey Punch. And for all of you holidaying on a yacht on the Mediterranean this summer, this is a must listen. More of that later. Back in the Film Weekly studio is Zan Brooks to review some of this week's releases. We'll be looking at WALL-E, Standard Operating Procedure, and Nick Rogue's return in Puffball. But first, not many cinematic releases get to preview at London's National Gallery, but Olivier Assayas's latest film, Summer Hours, did just that. It's a contemporary tale where art plays a central role, so much so that the film was actually supported by Paris's Musée d'Orsay, who lent the project several works of art. The story begins with a gathering of a family at the matriarch Hélène Berthier's house to decide what should be done with the valuable family art collection. I spoke to Olivier Assayas in Paris about working with Juliette Binoche and some of the most valuable pieces ever gathered for a movie. Olivier Assayas, welcome to Film Weekly. Thank you so much for speaking to us. And congratulations on your film Summer Hours, or L'Heure d'été, which
Thank
I have
you.
To say, I absolutely loved it, Olivier.
Thank
it,
you.
It was a return to the kind of loveliness and lightness of one of your early films, End of August, Early September.
Yes.
And I suppose you're back with the family again. Was there any reason for you returning to such a sort of a light piece about family structures?
Well,
after
yes, long? There's a very good reason, is that I missed it so much. There has been a logic that is completely outside of my control that just driving me to doing those, a few multinational films in a row. I mean, basically, I wanted to do, after I did Les Destinées Sentimentales, which was this period piece I did like in 2000.
With Emmanuel Béart.
With Emmanuel Béart and Charles Berling. I just needed to move on to something different. So I did Demon Lover, which was this modernist multinational movie, and then then I basically wanted to go back to something closer to home, and the movie just did not happen. And for some reason, A Clean happened, which was a project I had for a long time, and all of a sudden, it just happened.
And won the Best Actress for Maggie Cheung.
With Maggie Cheung and Nick Nolte, and then I did Boarding Gate. I mean, I did those movies also because for some reason the more French projects were not happening, and just all of a sudden this one clicked, and I was so happy. There was something very light and very happy about the whole process.
Yes,
and
when I say light, I mean that with a full compliment. I don't mean light as in fluffy.
Oh no, it's lightness is something that I value deeply. It's something that I've always been looking for, and especially when I was doing Late August, Early September, it's my concern was just trying to find with profound, deep subject, a lightness of touch that just makes them, just part of our everyday life.
Well, exactly. I mean, the film, it's interesting you say you want to do a film about France today, because the film is about home, not just France as home for you, but home as in where the heart is, and of course where the art is, if you could excuse the very difficult to pronounce English pun.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a film very much about how art lives on in a home, and how homes kind of reverberate with the sound of laughter and the sound of being lived in.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that you missed because you travelled so much and you did films about the world, that there was a sort of a lack of root, if you like, in your
life?
Well,
it's yes, of course, I experienced some of what the characters in L'Heure d'été experience. But also, I think something I've never lost touch with is the notion that art happens. It comes from life. It comes from nature. It comes from our humanity. I mean, it's something that always been that has always been very important to me. Movies should not be made out of cinephilia. They should not be made out of references to other movies. Movies should not deal with movie world. Movies should deal with life. And I think that life meaning, the simplest things in life. And that's what has always, in a way or another, inspired me. And I've always been extremely attached to the notion that the reference the point of reference when I'm making a movie should be my own experience of life, my own experience of the world, my own experience of the basic emotions of humanity.
One of the achievements of the film, I think, is when you have the wonderful Louis Majorelle desk, the beautiful Odilon Redon panels, the wonderful broken Degas sculpture that was broken because kids were playing with it one day. They seem to have an amazing kind of life to them because they're used yes. every day. Vases are used to put flowers in, these beautiful Boccaron vases. And when you suddenly see them at the end in the museum, in the Musée d'Orsay, they have a coldness to them. They don't seem as kind of warm. They don't seem as kind of organically part of the life of people.
Yeah. But they are like animals in a zoo. I wanted to film them really like animals in a zoo. It's, captive.
Obviously, all those were very valuable and very precious. But also a value and of great preciousness was the cast that you managed to assemble. Of course, someone like Juliette Binoche, who is equally a jewel, I suppose, and a national treasure of France, as Charles Melang is as well.
Yes.
How did you get Juliette, and what was it like to work with her? Because you mentioned that Hao Xiaoxian, I know you're a big admirer of that Taiwanese director. She was also in his film, The Flight of the Red Balloon, the remake that he did of that. So it's a cool part for her as well. She's kind of young. She's kind of funky. She's wearing like these like little hoodie tops and nice blonde hair, so I guess it was a good change for her.
I introduced her to a famous French designer, Nathalie Crasset, because she needed, Juliette needs to have very solid elements to build on, so she had a very abstract notion of what was a designer, a young woman being a designer today. So I introduced her to Nathalie Crasset, and Nathalie Crasset just lent her her clothes, her bag, everything that's presented in the film as the work of the character of Adrienne is the work of Nathalie Crasset. Juliette would be calling her day and night, asking, can I do this, can I do that, would you do this, would you do that? So, she had a very, she had a solid point of reference.
Well, I hope she washed them before she returned. Olivier, I know you're coming over to do a Q&A on Friday night at the Curzon May Fair with Jérémy Régnier.
With Jérémy Régnier, absolutely.
One of your stars, so people can come and see you there. But we thank you for the meantime for spreading your global wings far enough to come to us here in London. Olivier Assayas, merci beaucoup.
Well, thank you, merci beaucoup. It's been a pleasure.
And Summer Hours is on release in the UK from July the 18th. And as I said there, Olivier will be appearing in a Q&A at the Curzon Mayfair on Friday, June the 18th. For more information about that one, go to curzoncinemas.com. Coming up, we'll be talking to director Ollie Blackburn about his debut film, Donkey Punch. But first, we welcome into the Film Weekly studio, Zan Brooks. This week we'll be talking about WALL-E, we'll be talking about Standard Operating Procedure, and we'll be talking about Puffball. So let's start with WALL-E. WALL-E is Pixar and Disney collaborating once again. The story of a small robot left alone on a deserted Earth while in space the humans circulate around him.
700 years into the future, mankind will leave our planet, leaving Earth's cleanup in the hands of one incredible machine. His name is WALL-E. After all these years, he's developed one little glitch.
What?
A personality. He's extremely curious. And just a little bit lonely. But all that is about to change.
That's a bit of WALL-E there, Zan. Did you like WALL-E?
I liked WALL-E. I'm not sure I loved WALL-E.
Because you loved Ratatouille.
I did love Ratatouille, and I feel really crass saying this because WALL-E is already open to kind of, real rave reviews in the States. And it's seen as Pixar really pushing the envelope, really sort of going for the art house, high art kind of realm. And it is. It's brilliant. It's absolutely superb. It's a film that you can admire to the skies and back. And yet I'm not sure I loved it in the same way that I loved, frivolous little films like Ratatouille.
Well, strangely, I'm very much with you on that. I mean, it does look amazing. The shading is beautiful. The animation itself is beautiful. I was kind of a gasp at the beauty of the whole thing. What was it, do you think, that made you not love it so much? Because we've got this opening sequence, which is almost amazing. That it's 50 minutes of no talking, and kids are supposed to watch this?
Yes, exactly. I wondered what kind of It's a really tough one. I've been wrestling with what my problems with Wall-E are. For a while, I thought it might be that it was too sad. It's like one of the saddest cartoons I've ever seen. And I've seen Grave of the Fireflies, which is really sad. It's so melancholic. It's basically the apocalypse. It's the end of the world, according to Pixar, with the little robot left behind. It's a virtuoso segment, that opening segment. Mm. It's absolutely brilliant. I don't think it's the sadness. I think that it's a thing that it's almost too much of an aesthetic exercise. It doesn't really have a heart. It's very, very serious. It knows what it's saying. It does everything absolutely perfectly. And yet there's very little actual kind of warmth to it.
I was missing the spontaneity, the human flaws, perhaps. And to be honest, I was missing the jokes.
Absolutely.
I didn't think it was very funny.
It's not. There's no real jokes in there at all. I mean, you know, possibly, eventually Wally goes out to the space station where the human race has evolved into these kind of fat gastropods who kind of fall off of their recliners and sort of roll around on the floor. And I guess that's the comic relief. That's what you're supposed to laugh at. But basically, you're kind of laughing at what becomes of us.
Yes, I was wondering that as very sedentary people who don't have to struggle to get drinks, I thought perhaps it was a little sly dig at film critics.
Well, this is the thing, you know.
As I shuffled between screenings.
I'm sitting here with my smoothie now, slurping it through a straw. The other key thing is it has to be said that Wall-E comes kind of preceded by a Pixar short film called Presto, which is fun, is a stage magician battling with his rabbit who wants a carrot and won't get into the hat. And you kind of watch that and you love it and you enjoy it and think, oh, that's so clever, that's wonderful, it really does the business. Then you're kind of pitched headlong into the apocalypse and it's a bit of a downer.
It is. It's a bit like Kubrick, isn't it? There's this beautiful space warp between Wall-E and the robot. He falls in love with Eva. There's obviously parallels to E.T. as well. And I thought more than just parallels, it was kind of very, very similar. I mean, Wall-E looks a bit like E.T., doesn't he?
Yeah, there's a big kind of cultural crush in this film. I mean, you know, you could say there's a bit of Robinson Crusoe in there. There's a bit of sort of dystopian science fiction films like Silent Running, the old kind of Bruce Dern film. I also read that the kind of key pairing of Wall-E and Eve, the sort of pod that he falls in love with, is based on Woody Allen and Diane Keaton in Annie Hall.
Oh.
And you can kind of see that.
Well, I was thinking Sleeper at some point.
Yes, it's all Sleeper.
I just thought that, yeah, like you, I wanted something lovable, maybe a song or something. Am I so crass?
I think we're both so crass. I think that Pixar are sort of boldly going where no animation studio has gone before with this film, and we've kind of been left behind.
Yeah, I did like the final credits of the film, which are kind of sort of the history of art. It starts with cave painting, goes through hieroglyphics, up to Fauvism and Da Vinci, and I just thought, you know, which five-year-old is going to be marvelling? Oh, I see, they've aped Seurat's Pointilliste style there.
They don't care about five-year-olds anymore. This is the thing. They've gone. They're out there.
Pixar for adults. I did wonder when Disney and Pixar should get together. Shouldn't they be called Pixie or something? But maybe that's just too kind of...
That's one for the lawyers.
Right. Zan, that's Wall-E. Neither of us loved it. Although Sigourney Weaver does play the kind of sexy computer, but kind of scary. She's the kind of go-to woman at the moment. Isn't she in Be Kind Rewind? She turns up as a kind of... Because they do Ghostbusters in that, so they get her in there to be the face of corporate evil running over the video, the Swedish videos they do. And here she is again, kind of being the kind of, you know, Hal-like voice of the computer.
It's the sort of the option for... actresses in their 40s and 50s, I guess. So you become the voice of the face of corporate evil.
Well, I suppose there's a lot of corporate evil in our next film, Standard Operating Procedure, a new documentary by Errol Morris, an Oscar winner and one of the greats of the documentary genre. Here he's examining the photographic evidence put before the world when the horrors of Abu Ghraib prison were revealed.
Somebody caught our administration with the pants down. That's it. They're pissed off at that. You can kill people off camera, you can shoot people, you could, you know, blow their heads off. As long as it's not on camera, you're okay. But if it's on camera, you're done. You know, torture didn't happen in those photographs. That was humiliation. That was softening up. Torture happened during interrogations. Guys going through interrogation, and they're dead, and they were killed, and they died. That's where the torture happened. We don't have photographs of that.
Errol Morris, I think one of the finest, slickest documentary makers around. How did Standard Operating Procedure work its magic on you, Zan?
I thought it was Great. I mean, I guess if you're looking for an even bleaker film than Wall-E, you've certainly got it here. I mean, this is just sort of got evil in its DNA. It goes right through the whole film. It's the great kind of atrocity of our time, I guess. And Errol Morris is probably the best person to tackle this. Having said that, I kind of think that Alex Gibney's film Taxi to the Dark Side tackled the material slightly better in that it found the sort of human story in a way that Morris doesn't.
This one was very oppressive, this film. I mean, I found it very, very hard going. Not in that kind of, oh, I really would like to have some songs in my Wall-E. I just found this very, very flat almost. I found it kind of constantly badgering and kind of bludgeoning.
But that's the thing with Morris, that he is the sort of the great claustrophobic documentary maker of our time. Sometimes that works better than with other material. I think that a film that he made about 20 years ago called The Thin Blue Line is one of the great documentaries ever made, which takes a cop killing in Dallas and unpicks it and spins it out and finds all these different angles into it. This is almost too enormous a subject matter for him to frame. You do need the human element. You need some kind of hook to get you in there. Morris doesn't give you that. And I guess that's intentional. I mean, he's a master filmmaker. He knows exactly what he's doing. And he's just pushing this stuff against your face.
He does give us lots of humans, however. He gives us people like Lindy England and Megan, what's-her-face, Grainer, the people who were kind of the perps in this crime, if you like, or at least the ones that presented to us as the perps. They're not very nice people to spend so much time with big on a screen like that. I mean, their faces are pretty scary and their testimonies are pretty scary. And I just thought, well, I don't really want to hear what you've got to say. You are not very nice.
You can't close your eyes and ears to this stuff, Jason. This is what Morris would lambast you for feeling. He's basically presenting this as, you know, war crimes evidence. This is like The Hague playing out on the cinema screen. No, these aren't nice people. No, particularly Lindy England seemed pretty unrepentant about what she did.
Although, looks more and more like Roseanne Barr as well. It was striking, I thought.
Yes.
I can see the film remake.
I'm just wondering about a sort of non-libelous response to that. That's not going to get Roseanne Barr. It's lawyers coming after us.
You know, that's what I thought was a bit. I had a problem. There was a slyness at work. He's getting these people into a studio, lighting them very nicely, and saying, "Yes, come, please sit here, Ms. England, and tell us all about your stuff, and kind of make an impassioned defence for yourself." But isn't he just giving them rope to hang themselves with?
Yeah, that's what he does. That's his speciality. I mean, Errol Morris used to be a private investigator before he was a documentary filmmaker. So he is brilliant at bringing people out of themselves. Perhaps he's less brilliant at drawing conclusions, passing judgment. But again, he would say that that's not what this film is about. That's for us to do.
Mm. And I think that's what Gibney did. I suppose it's better easy because he kind of made it in a way like that conspiracy thriller films do. They made the corruption go all the way up to the top.
Yeah.
So you can sort of sit there and go blaming Cheney and blaming Bush. Yeah. And that's fine because they hang themselves every day in public and it's their job to do so. We're getting the real people here. So I had that kind of ambivalence because I loved The Fog of War. I thought it was a wonderful documentary. Mm. And McNamara, I was happy to see him sort of hang himself there. This one, I almost found it kind of repellent. But then it is about repellent stuff.
Yes, there's no way out of it. There's no conclusion apart from the fact that this happened and here are these people talking about it. Maybe there's a basic human need to actually have answers, to have these are the people who are responsible, this is what we can take away from, some kind of prepackaged message. This film doesn't give that.
I thought it was strange as well. There was lots of shots of little cameras because, in a way, it's almost about documentary evidence and about photography and whether you can doctor photos. There were lots of shots. The film is distributed by Sony, there were lots of shots of Sony CyberShot cameras taking the pictures. I didn't know if they were kind of condoning this. Someone was saying, "Look what you can do with a Sony CyberShot."
It's a strange message to send, isn't it? That if you're committing an atrocity, use Sony to record that special moment.
You're worried about Roseanne Barr's lawyers? Moving on to our final film of the week, it's Puffball. It finds Nicholas Rogue back on the big screen after a long absence, with Kelly Riley, Miranda Richardson and Rita Tushingham in tow, all set in a cottage in Ireland as they try to get pregnant.
I don't have to see it to believe it.
Baby, you just stole it from me!
Greedy bitch coming down
down here taking what's not hers.
Everything's gonna be okay. Everything's gonna be okay.
Nick Rogue is back, Zan. Is that a reason to be cheerful?
It kind of is, in that this film finally provides the light relief that I think we've been looking for, in that it's a disaster. It's a calamity. And it's unintentionally very, very funny. I hate to say it because I think that Nick Rogue is one of the great directors of our time. I think he's a brilliant, brilliant filmmaker. He's altogether unique.
And you're thinking all the way back to like his role in Performance and
Performance, Don't Look Now, Bad Timing. He's a master, but he's an old master. And this is his first feature film in over a decade. And he's kind of lost it on the evidence of this. This is a sort of occult sexual burlesque set in rural Ireland with lots of overacting and ludicrous kind of plot leaps and sort of pivoting around a mystical stone in the woods that kind of makes people shag a lot. It's kind of stupid.
It is based on a Faye Weldon book, and it does kind of have his normal themes in there, fertility and women trying to get pregnant and women trying to procreate and these kind of sexual urges and breasts and lots of hair as well. Amazing
hair.
Red hair from Miranda Richardson. Kelly Riley has lustrous locks in this film. I did wonder what it was. I mean, because there's a sex scene in there that reminded me very much of the sex scene in Don't Look Now, that very controversial one with Donald Sutherland, who also has lots of hair, and Judy Christie, who also has lots of hair, and it was shot above, and it's all in the hay, and Donald Sutherland even pops up in this one.
Yeah, Donald Sutherland pops up in like two scenes and kind of wanders through them with a sort of bemused smile of a man who looks like he's forgotten something but can't quite remember what it is. And that's the sort of the overriding message and air of the film as a whole, I think. Yes, there is a sex scene that perhaps references Don't Look Now, but it references it in a real sort of reflexive, half-remembered kind of way.
I just wondered if perhaps there's a germ of a really good idea here, or there's a germ of a great filmmaker, or is there any vestiges of what was great about it?
Yeah, there's vestiges, but perhaps that's the saddest thing of all. Of course, Nick Rogue deserves all the respect that we can give him. He's one of the key filmmakers of our time. But he doesn't deserve respect for this. You can't... No matter how much kind of reflected glory and no matter how much history he comes trailing, you have to judge him on the work in question. And this work in question is a mess. It's a disaster.
Sam Brooks, thank you very much indeed. Big thanks to Zan Brooks there. Remember, you can catch up with Zan's musings on the cinematic arts and more besides at guardian.co.uk/film. Zan is standing in for the great Peter Bradshaw this week, so you can see and read more of him there. Now, we here at Observer Film Weekly like to think we're an international brand, but it has to be said, I do get a slight thrill when I spot emerging British talent, and that's the feeling I got this week when I saw Oliver Blackburn's Donkey Punch, made by the uber-cool Warp X Films, an offshoot of the music label. Donkey Punch tells of three young girlfriends from Leeds off to sunny Spain for a holiday. There they meet up with three equally dishy young British men and begin a party that goes horribly wrong.
Can't we get a bottle of wine and drink it here?
You're welcome to come back to the yacht and have a drink with us. Yeah?
Right, you were nicking drinks, but you've got a yacht.
We just wanted you to like us for who we really are.
You do not have a boat.
Kim, they do. I saw dinghy parked over there.
Daddy's boat.
Of course it is.
No, we're crew. You know this boat's in the marina? We crew one of those.
You're sailors?
We're just going back off a 3-month stint. The owner flew out yesterday, as did the skipper. I'm the second mate. Josh here is the deckie.
Skivvy, more like.
Well, what are you then? The onboard hairdresser?
International playboy. Just flew in from Bifa to check out my old Maca de Coos.
Look, the new crew arrive on Monday. This is our last weekend together. What do you say?
Lead the way.
And I've got two of the Donkey Punch posse in the studio with me now. Director Ollie Blackburn and star Julian Morris. Welcome to Film Weekly, guys. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
You're dry, you're fresh from your premiere, your big London glitzy event. Is that, when you start your film directing career, is that something you want to have? Is that the big affirmation that you've arrived?
It's pretty nice. First of all, I'm not that fresh. It's Wednesday. I'm still slightly recovering from Monday's premiere.
I'm still drunk.
Julian's still drunk. But it's just amazing for a film that was fairly low budget that we had that big event and it was had all that glitz. It was in the papers. It's a really special feeling that a film this small can have that kind of visibility.
What I liked about the film, Ollie, which I know you kind of co-wrote and directed, was that it got the atmosphere right. It seemed to get things right that it set out to do. It got the feeling of kind of the summer feeling. It got the kind of sex and drugs and rock and roll feeling right. And was that the key to making a small film like this have a big appeal?
Yeah, and also it was, I co-wrote it with my friend David Bloom, and although we're a little older than the characters, a lot of it was kind of based in our experiences and our memories of taking those sort of holidays and that wonderful experience of lying on a beach and having a bit to drink and, dare I say it, having had maybe half a pill or something, and, you know, and the music is playing. And it's just those beautiful, those moments you remember forever. And we wanted to really capture that feeling in the first part of the film, which, although the film is very dark, the first part is very bright and very light. And
exactly. I mean, is there a problem when you're approaching a film like this? Because there is a sort of great moral majority here in England, where these sort of people will tut at the film. As it's called Donkey Punch, and we'll let our listeners find out what that means for itself. And you've slipped that past the censors, I think. But, I mean, there is a sort of element here where we don't do this sort of thing in British film. I've never really seen British films go this far in terms of their kind of genre pieces.
First of all, you know, newsflash, British people like to have fun, they like to have sex, they like to let their hair down, contrary to maybe how we've been presented to the world, we're not all sort of miserable, sexless, repressed Victorians. And, you know, and if this film, I think this film shows people what they really think English people are like, which is, you know, stylish and fun and out for a good time. And actually, both the boys and the girls in the film are really intelligent, aware characters. I'm sure it will shake things up. It's meant to. It's a, you know, it's a provocative film. And if you make a provocative film that people don't talk about, then I think you failed. So that would be great if people talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Ollie. It's a bold British film, but it's totally British. And I think it is something that's great for the British market, because it is from top to bottom, the talent behind the camera, in front of the camera, the money, it's all British. And I think it speaks volumes, the type of cinema that we're capable of making.
Let's talk about that low budgetness and that Britishness of it, Ollie, because it is funded by Warp Films, who are the offshoot of the music label, and they've got into film, and they started with the Shane Meadows clan, and they've built from there. What were they like to work with, and how do they encourage you? And what is it that's warpish about the film?
Well, I think it's edginess and it's provocativeness, and also it's very true to its roots, the film. It's, you know, we wanted to make a film that's a genre film that's anchored in very British realities of people going for these holidays, and I think that's very Warp. I think the work they've done with Shane Meadows is amazing, and I actually felt a little nervous when I first met with them. You know, how could I possibly, you know, match, you know, things like Dead Man's Shoes and This Is England? But they are very down-to-earth people, and what they take from the music industry thing is this philosophy of doing something that is challenging and inventive and doing it on your own terms and not getting bogged down. You know, in the film industry, it's very easy to get stuck, and, you know,
you've had scripts floating around the business for ages with various producers.
That's right. And Warp, you know, particularly Mark Herbert, has this energy where he just drives things through. And if he says something will be done, it gets done.
Let's just talk about the girls, because, I mean, of course, one of them seems to be getting all the limelight at the moment is lovely little Jamie Winston, who is terrific in the film,
she's
I have
brilliant.
To say. What's she like to work with?
Oh, she's fantastic. As an actress to work with, she just gives it to you in every single scene. You can't ask more than that. She's loads of fun, and she's see the movie. She is brilliant.
Yeah. Well, how did you get to cast her? Because, I mean, she's become incrementally more kind of tabloidy and famous since you shot the film.
Well, everyone on the film, you know, we had a very long casting process that was 7 months, and we saw a lot of people. And luckily, because it's a low budget film, we weren't forced to go for name cast. We couldn't afford that. Mm. So I got to cast the people who were right for the film. And there's no one in the film who's there for any reason other than the fact they're a great actor and that they were the right person for that role. And Jamie is just, it's a very tough role that she plays. She has to do some very brave things. And she just, you know, her work ethic is unbelievable, and it just shows on the screen.
Did you, I mean, I, I written a piece in The Observer last week about Gurinder Chadha, who had to change the name of her film, Angus, Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging, because they couldn't get a PG certificate because of full frontal, but slightly a rude word. I mean, your film is called Donkey Punch, which is named after a sex act. Anyone who's seen the film, it's explained quite clearly, and you can look it up on the internet. I didn't know what it was, innocent as I am, until this. I mean, were you challenged on the name? Did the censors ever come back to you and say, this is a Donkey Punch? And, or did they think it was, you know, like a drink or something?
No, I mean, interestingly enough, I actually wanted to change the name for a long time. Many people sort of, you know, called me out on it, said, you can't, it's a great name. And I just kept running into more and more people who kept saying, I don't know what it means, but it sounds great. What does it mean? And it's a mysterious name. You want to know what the conjunction of those words mean.
Because it is rude. I mean, it is kind of, you know, it's a sex
It's sick
act.
And rude.
It's a real one, is it?
No, I think it's... I think like all these things, and there's thousands of them, and if you want to explore more, the internet will, you know, has many treasures to sift through. You know, I think like all these things, they're ridiculous, they're obscene. My brother calls it squaddy humour. It's, you know, it's like you're pissed and you just say these things amongst your bunch of mates, then someone else comes up with something even more crazy and you kind of bat them around and they're actually pretty funny.
Julian, I know something, good things have come out of this from you. I know it's only just out here in the UK, but you've just come back from filming with Tom Cruise.
Yeah,
you've just
wild.
Told me.
Yeah.
My God. Doing what?
Doing Valkyrie, the film Valkyrie that Bryan Singer directs. Terrific war movie, and Tom Cruise is incredibly good in it.
Really? Have you seen it then?
I've seen the ending of it, and I've seen bits of it, because there's a lot of this like drama around it about the release date and reshoots, but it's going to be fantastic.
So are you friends with Tom? Did you shoot Paul with Tom?
We had dinner together in the desert. He was we're filming in the desert, and he was camping. So I don't know why, but I expected like tents, admittedly big tents. So he invites me over for dinner, and I get there, and it's this $4 million trailer. Next to it are like two helicopters, there's a Bentley, a Lamborghini, and this personal chef is cooking the most sumptuous barbecue I've ever tasted in my life. But then after all that, you know, we're sharing a beer and talking movies like we're doing now. So
do send my regards to Tom.
I will.
Give him our Film Weekly regards.
Cool.
So he can cook for us anytime.
Fantastic.
Congratulations to you on Donkey Punch, and to you, Ollie Blackburn, on a debut. I do wish you the best of luck with it. I think this is one of those kind of strange British films that might actually be a hit at the box office with its target audience.
Well,
my
knock
God.
On wood, but everyone out there, go see it. You won't be disappointed.
Thanks to Ollie Blackburn and Julian Morris there. Donkey Punch is on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 18th of July. And it goes without saying that, produced by Warp, Donkey Punch has an excellent soundtrack released on Warp Records. It includes tracks by Plaid, Broadcast, Justice vs. Simeon and Block Party. We've got 3 copies of that soundtrack to give away. All you've got to do is tell us in which British city is Warp based. In which British city is Warp based? And to win those copies of the soundtrack, email us at film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. That's film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. Well, that's all for another edition of Observer Film Weekly. Next week, we'll be at the BritDoc Festival, coming to you live from Oxford, where the cream of documentary talent will be gathered, and we'll be there to cover it for you. Any thoughts on the films we've covered this week, do, as ever, post on my blog by going to guardian.co.uk/blogs and clicking on film. If you want more news and views on film, pick up The Observer every Sunday for my trailer trash column, of course. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and from Jason Phipps, my producer back in the saddle this week, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.